Russian Olympics, past and present. Today, Friday, February 7th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Sochi Winter Olympics are now officially underway amid tight security. And this veteran correspondent says Russians are ready to focus on their athletes.
You know, this is a sporting nation, you know, even if it's one with kind of cigarettes hanging out of their mouths half the time.
Olympic flames of a different kind, I guess. Also, a Muscovite looks back on Russia's last Olympics, the 1980 Summer Games.
I think me and everybody I know remember that closing ceremony like a symbol of the end of the childhood and end of the Soviet period.
And our history guide delves into Sochi's violent history. Circassians, anyone? Plus, a Polish painting looted by the Nazis is returned 70 years later. That's all ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The flame over the Olympic cauldron is lit, and Russian President Vladimir Putin finally had his moment today, declaring the 2014 Winter Games in Sochi officially open. Putin and Russia have a lot at stake in these games, at a cost of $50 billion. These are the most expensive Olympics ever, but it's more than that, much more. This is, after all, the first time the country hosts the Olympics since the breakup of the Soviet Union. The mood in Sochi earlier was joyful and celebratory as more than 3,000 athletes marched during the opening ceremony. But what's the mood in Russia's capital? That's a question I put to correspondent Charles Maines in Moscow.
Actually, surprisingly quiet. I mean, there are a few bars as you kind of wander around town where they've got a screen set up, but it almost seems as though the capital is not paying that much attention to the Olympics, oddly enough.
Our listeners here in the U.S. will see the ceremonies hours after they actually happen, so I don't want you to spoil all the extravagance, but what's it been like watching these opening ceremonies and the way Russia is being presented to the world?
Well, you know, it's a little bit like history kind of collapsing on itself. I mean, you see these, I don't want to give too much away but and be a spoiler, but it does seem as though, you know, you see all these kind of aspects of Russian history kind of colliding into one. So there are sort of themes of Russian fairy tales. There's references to great Russian poets and writers like Pushkin. There is bits of ballet, sort of touching on Soviet achievements, cosmonauts. And just to bring it up to the present tense, there's also a really bad Russian DJ spinning some pretty bad music.
So. Right, which I saw somebody tweet on online. Gee, that sounds like very gay disco music. So who knows? Is the image then of a stern society being replaced by some warm and fuzzy image of Russia?
No, I mean, I think they put on a, so what I've seen so far anyway, it looks like a pretty good show. And I think that's what was pretty much expected. I mean, certainly they've put enough money into this to make it a good show. And, you know, there are these moments which maybe have little echoes of the Moscow 80 Olympics, sort of a Soviet style Olympics, and Putin kind of up in the rafters, standing sort of solemnly as the Russian athletes go by and things like that. But on the whole, I think it's been a pretty good show so far.
So what's actually on Putin's mind as far as how all of this, you know, recasting Russia's image, the Olympics itself, how it's going to help Russia on the world stage?
Well, it's a big question. I mean, obviously, these games are of enormous importance to Putin. He's put a lot of his own personal capital into this and obviously a lot of money. As we know, these games are now the most expensive in history. But in terms of what Russia gets out of it, I mean, it is a big PR project. I think this is designed to show Russia as something, as kind of a new Russia, sort of a more open Russia. And that's obviously backfired in a lot of ways, given some of the controversies that have been ahead of these games. It's interesting to me just to look at this opening ceremony and see the way that they've tried to tackle some of these issues. For example, the issue with the LGBT, the gay rights in Russia. It's expected that a Russian group Tattoo, which some listeners may remember as a pop duo that were kind of promoted as lesbians, they're supposed to be the actually opening act to sort of close up these ceremonies today. And, you know, that seems like kind of a smart move, I suppose, in terms of the Kremlin to try and show that, you know, they are more open than perhaps they've been perceived.
So, Charles, you're heading down to Sochi next week once the games are really underway. What are you looking forward to seeing, kind of the events, the athletic events, or more how Sochi and Russia are processing this big event?
A little bit of both, frankly. You know, I think that, you know, even those who are critics of these games, and there are many, you know, they're in a somewhat awkward position because, of course, there are so many problems. You look at human rights, abuse of migrants, environmental concerns, and obviously the corruption that's been much in the headlines. But, you know, this is also a sporting nation, you know, even if it's one with kind of cigarettes hanging out of their mouths half the time. And, you know, I think Russians are really excited about these games and excited to see the athletes. And so it's hard not to kind of root for the athletes in that setting.
Journalist Charles Maines, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
The last time the Olympics happened in this part of the world was in 1980 in a country that no longer exists, the Soviet Union. Those were the summer games that Americans knew little about. The U.S. had led a boycott of the Moscow Olympics to protest the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, but the games went on. I remember Misha, the bear mascot for the games, but like many Americans, my memory of those Olympics is mostly hazy. For Russians, though, the games were mesmerizing. The World's Julia Barton caught up with one man who remembers it all very well.
My name is Yuri Saprykin. The chief editor of, in Russian it's called Afisha Vozduch. It's an online cultural review. I was 7 years old.
Misha, the bear cub has become the keepsake of the Moscow Olympics.
All the Soviet cultural machine worked for the kids and made animation films and beautiful movies and books and everything. So for me, Olympic Games was one of the cultural projects for kids. It looked like that.
Весь мир за, а баба яга против.
Before the Olympic Games, you saw on the TV funny animation films about the Baba Yaga, evil hero of the Russian fairy tales, who tried to organize boycott.
Yes. Я проникаю в трубу! Он не выйдет из леса!
Moscow welcomed its guests. They came to the Olympic Games with cameras, bicycles, sabers, boxing gloves, and high hopes.
Of course, everybody was upset because of the boycott, but TV channels tried to find good examples of the sportsman who was boycotting the boycott.
The way to Moscow was not easy for the sport delegations of some countries. There was a campaign to boycott the games, and this cannot be passed over in silence.
You know, in 1980, there was a really strong reason for a boycott. It was invasion in Afghanistan. And I think that maybe not me, but the adults understood it very well. So I don't remember any hostile feelings for Americans. You know, in the late Soviet Union, even for ordinary people, any event which brings together many foreign citizens, it was really a holiday. It was so strange and beautiful to see completely different people which doesn't look like us from another side of the Iron Curtain. For 2 or 3 weeks we looked at the sports competitions. And then there was a closing ceremony of the Olympic Games when Mishka flew away into the sky, and I think every Soviet kid at the moment broke in tears. It was very sentimental, very moving moment. It was like end of the beautiful fairy tale. Everybody felt the same. I think me and everybody I know remember that closing ceremony like a symbol of the end of the childhood and end of the Soviet period. I think my own children don't know much about Olympics. They don't wait for it. It doesn't look like a kid's holiday. It looks like a big state-sponsored event which must show all the world that Russia is a wealthy and solid state. I don't know. It's not for kids.
Soviet Olympics Memory Lane, and that was editor and columnist Yuri Saprykin speaking with the world's Julia Barton in Moscow. See what that Soviet architecture from the 1980 Olympics looks like now. It's a far cry from the sites in Sochi, that's for sure. We have a slideshow at PRI.org. Diplomatic tensions between the U.S. and Russia are not a bygone relic of the Cold War, and one recent flashpoint has been Ukraine. Russia has accused the U.S. of manipulating the political crisis there, and this week the Russians pointed to this as evidence.
That would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the U.N. help glue it and, you know, f*** the EU.
No, exactly, and I think we've got to do something to make it stick together.
That's a leaked recording of the U.S. ambassador in Ukraine speaking on the phone with Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland. They were talking about the possibility of imposing economic sanctions on Ukraine's government. That would annoy the Russians. Now, Nuland's use of profanity also didn't go over very well in Europe. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said Nuland's remarks were totally unacceptable. Nick Burns is a former top U.S. diplomat who's now at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and he puts the blame for this diplomatic snafu at the feet of Moscow.
The Russians want to present a picture of American intervention in Ukraine's internal affairs. It's not true. The United States is just trying to help the millions of Ukrainians who don't want to have to live as a vassal state to Russia under Russia's shadow. And so I think what the U.S. hopes is that some of the more reform-minded leaders of the opposition would be able to come into the government and to help turn that government towards the future of Ukraine, which is an integrated future with the peoples of Europe. There's a lot at stake here because Ukraine, as you know, is a major state in the middle of Europe, and the Russians are fighting tooth and nail to preserve their age-old client relationship. They're the master, Ukraine is the client, with the leadership in Kiev.
The State Department said this is, quote, a new low for Russian tradecraft. Do you think Moscow's actually trying to embarrass Washington?
Oh, I think the Russians have been trying to embarrass the United States for many years now. The Russians feel that Ukraine is part of their future. And, of course, Ukraine used to be the second most important republic of the Soviet Union. They don't want to see Ukraine drift towards the West. It's very much in our interest to see the Ukrainian people given the right to choose their own future and not have it imposed upon them by the Russian government. So I think our Assistant Secretary of State, Victoria Nuland, is absolutely right. And she's obviously carrying out President Obama and Secretary Kerry's policy, which is to give the people of Ukraine the choice as to where they want to be located. Do they want to have an association with the European Union, or do they want to remain attached in a very difficult way to the Russian Federation? And you see that millions of Ukrainians are out demonstrating to have that right to determine their own future, and the United States has an obvious interest in helping them get there.
Where does the frustration at the State Department with the EU come from?
Well, you know, the United States has an advantage. We are a very unified government led by the president, with the Secretary of State directing on a day-to-day basis our foreign policy operations. The European Union is a union of 27 countries. It acts more slowly. It tends to be quite reactive to events, and I think some of the frustration sometimes is that while the United States wants to move out quickly and decisively, sometimes Europe takes a while to get itself together. But I wouldn't think there's a crisis here. I think this is a tempest in a teapot, some of the unhappiness we're hearing from Europe.
I mean, Angela Merkel seemed distressed by the release of this conversation. Does the use of the F-word cast Victoria Nuland in, well, and the State Department, for that matter, in an unnecessarily negative light?
Well, you know, you have to remember, this was a private conversation between two Americans. Somebody got a hold of that conversation. It certainly wasn't the United States government. And someone put it on YouTube. And I think the reasonable suspicion is that it was the Russian government out trying to embarrass the United States. So I wouldn't judge Assistant Secretary Nuland harshly at all. They were having a frank conversation. She is the model of an effective diplomat.
So you don't agree with the Russians at all when they say the U.S. is meddling in Ukrainian affairs?
That is Russian sophistry. It's absolutely untrue. The country that's meddling and intimidating in Ukraine is Russia.
Nick Burns at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Thank you as always.
Thank you so much.
This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. With the Winter Olympics now on, Russia's controversial anti-gay law will continue getting a lot of attention. But just over a month ago, an even harsher anti-gay law went into effect in Nigeria. Same-sex relations were already illegal there, but the new law bans public displays of affection between people of the same sex. It also outlaws any group involved in what officials deem to be gay issues, including HIV and AIDS prevention. The BBC's Will Ross is based in Nigeria. He recently visited a state in the northern part of the country that is using local citizens to round up those it suspects of being gay. So, Will, you went to Bauchi State. How have authorities been trying to enact the law there?
Basically, in Bauchi State, they've got Islamic law, Sharia law. It's in the predominantly Muslim north of the country, and many of the states there practice Sharia law. And what's been happening over the last few weeks, a local newspaper last year published an article which said that gay people in Bauchi had formed an association, and there was a list of names there. Now, the Sharia Commission thought it right to go after these people. They didn't manage to get any of them, so they then turned to imams in the mosques, in the churches. The message was put out, basically go out into your communities and look for these gay people and hand them over to us, literally going house to house, picking them up, and then taking them to the Sharia Commission. And there are currently 9 people in the prison there in Bauchi up on homosexuality charges. Worth mentioning that under Sharia law, the penalty for anybody caught having gay sex is a death sentence. And although a death sentence hasn't been carried out yet in the north of Nigeria for any crimes, death sentences have been passed but not carried out. And the Sharia Commission officials I spoke to there said to me that it's either death by stoning, pushing off a high building, or hanging.
Gosh. I mean, it's weird that I have to say alleged crime, but these 9 people, the crime they are alleged to have committed is being homosexual. I mean, were they turned in by neighbors or acquaintances?
That's exactly it. Neighbors set upon them, and the feeling, I mean, I went around talking to people, gauging the opinion, what people think about the whole issue of homosexuality, and everybody I spoke to either quoted the Bible or quoted the Quran and said that they're totally against homosexuality. They want all of the homosexuals to be arrested. I didn't hear anybody who had a sympathetic word to say, or anybody who was willing to defend them and say that it's their right. Just last month, on the 22nd of January, when there was a bail hearing for 7 of the accused, a large mob assembled outside the Sharia court, which is a pretty ramshackle tin roof building right in the middle of Bauchi City, and they started shouting and protesting and calling for swift justice, some of them even calling for that death sentence. Rocks were thrown at the court. One even went through the courtroom window and hit somebody, drawing blood from somebody who was actually in the court. And in the end, the whole case had to be halted. The police had to fire into the air to disperse the crowd and get the accused, the 9 men, safely back to the prison. But as I say, they're not, it seems, safe in the prison. And the people who are trying to get them out on bail say if they do get them out on bail, they'll either, you know, flee that part of the country or go into hiding because of this sort of feverish anti-homosexual drive that's going on in Bauchi at the moment.
The BBC's Will Ross reporting from Nigeria. Thank you very much, Will.
You're welcome.
A different sort of culture war is going on in Israel. A couple of years ago, Israeli lawmakers decided to require that Orthodox Jewish families send their kids to do military service, just like other Jewish Israelis. But instead of enlisting them, the government continued subsidizing their religious studies. Until this week, when the government shut off the funding. Reporter Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem picks up the story from there.
This is what happened next. Riots. Thousands of ultra-Orthodox Jewish activists took to the streets in their signature black hats and jackets. Police say about 2,000 protesters shut down a major highway. Hundreds more tried to block the main road into Jerusalem. Police sprayed them with water cannons. A leading rabbi at a protest yesterday warned Israel's leaders, "Our boys would rather commit suicide than give up learning Torah. Throw us in jail," he said. "We'll all go." This fight starts with the Holocaust. Jewish religious schools across Europe were decimated. So when Israel was founded, the state agreed to let a few hundred men rebuild the world of Jewish scholarship that was lost, instead of going into the army. But over time, nearly all ultra-Orthodox men have skipped army service and instead have been paid to sit and study Torah. The mass army exemption was supposed to end 2 years ago, but it didn't happen. And Uri Regev refuses to let it lie.
The government has done everything possible to avoid implementing this decision and keep paying them the subsidies, which come to the tune of some billion shekels a year.
That's a couple hundred million dollars. Regev is with Chidush, an Israeli organization advocating religious equality. His organization and others petitioned Israel's Supreme Court to stop subsidizing religious study centers whose students dodged the draft. This week, they succeeded.
What is at stake is not merely Israel's security. It is also, and no less than that, a battle over the rule of law, over the nature of Israeli democracy.
Israel has undergone a political shift in the last year. Ultra-Orthodox political parties were tossed out of the ruling coalition, replaced by a center-left coalition that says it wants the ultra-Orthodox or Haredi minority to pull its weight, to serve in the army, to get into the workforce, to integrate into Israeli society.
They do not look at themselves as parasites.
Jonathan Rosenblum is an American-born columnist for a leading ultra-Orthodox weekly. His community takes its Torah study very seriously, because without a strong commitment to Torah, he says, Jews will lose their spiritual identity.
That's where the community, the Haredi community, gets up on its back legs and says, wait a second, our first commitment is to the Jewish people, even before the state of Israel, to the Jewish people.
Rosenblum went to Yale Law, and his boys attend one of the most prestigious religious study centers in Israel. While soldiers are carrying out nighttime operations, his kids are up in the wee hours of the night studying complicated religious texts.
This is the attitude that we try and instill in them. You are a soldier. You are a soldier. And you have to take seriously that your Torah protects.
But he admits not everyone in the community needs to be studying round the clock. And in fact, ultra-Orthodox society has been evolving on its own. The community is poor, and more young ultra-Orthodox men are signing up for the military, in part to learn skills that can help them get a job. His advice to the Israeli government? Don't push the community into a corner.
Let this evolutionary process take place, and it's taking place far more rapidly over the last 10 years than anyone would have ever expected. From our own internal pressures, financial pressures, economic, there's a rule in economics that trends that cannot continue forever won't.
The trend of ultra-Orthodox men dodging the draft and the workforce, he believes that will end gradually. But he thinks forcing the community's hand, like this week's sudden funding freeze and the police detention of a draft dodger, only encourages more violent protests like yesterday's. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
You're listening to The World on PRI and PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman. If you're headed to Sochi and find yourself sitting down to dinner with Russians, beware the vodka.
In some cases, 20, 30 rounds of toast even before the meal begins, and that oftentimes is enough to get even the most alcohol-tolerant person a little bit tipsy.
Russia's relationship with vodka, ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. If you believe one popular Russian TV star, Sochi is the center of the universe today. That's what Yana Churikova announced to the crowd at the Olympic Stadium as spectators were still taking their seats for today's opening ceremonies. Well, for our next guest, Sochi has been the center of the universe recently. Paul Varadian is a Boston business consultant and a former bobsledder. He's been a frequent visitor to Sochi for the past few years, working on behalf of European clients who've needed to secure accommodations and other assistance. Varadian has heard all the reports about the last-minute construction frenzy and the unfinished hotel rooms, and he says he's not surprised.
And it shouldn't surprise anyone, actually. Every Olympic Games that we've ever had has always been a last-minute rush to completion. In this case here, I think it was even more challenging because you have the world's largest construction project going on in a country that's never done this sort of stuff, didn't have the labor to do it, didn't have the engineering skills to do it. And so a lot of this was really created overnight, so to speak. So it comes as no surprise that there are lingering issues, but I'm quite convinced, given the Russian government's position, that everything will be, it'll all work out.
Take us behind the scenes, because I saw a little preview on NBC the other night of just all they've been doing. One single building, the International Broadcast Center. I mean, it's been in the planning stages since the London Olympics, and construction has been going at a frantic pace since October. Do the Olympic people walk around? Do the Olympic people travel with like a whole city in a box that they set up, and then they have to unfold this thing in preparation for the games?
Well, yes and no. I mean, in this case here, you've got a situation where this is the largest sporting event in the world, and there's an enormous amount of infrastructure that goes into it. And you have to remember that with so many countries participating, each country is bringing their own set of athletes, families, sponsors, and media, television, radio, newspaper, journalists. So there's quite a few people in the support side of the equation, and that's what you see.
I think it was 2007 that the choice was made for the Winter Olympics in Sochi. It was announced that year, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
We choose 7 years before each Olympic Games.
Now, I don't know what you knew about Sochi in 2007, but we do know that there are a number of extremist groups operating around this region. Not in Sochi, not necessarily nearby, but it's not far away. What were your thoughts when you heard that Sochi was chosen?
We weren't surprised because this was, you know, Russia's 11 time zones. It's a very large country. And this is the only place where it's semi-tropical. It's the only place where any existing sort of ski areas were functioning. And so it was the choice by the Russian government to essentially promote Sochi. A lot of people also don't know that as soon as the Olympics is over, they're immediately building a Formula One track in the middle of the Olympic Village for an October Formula One race. And Sochi will also be the site of the 2018 World Cup soccer games. And, you know, they've poured an enormous amount of money into it. There is a greater risk, but the amount of security that's being put up by the Russian government is beyond description. And I think things will be quite safe.
So you've been working in marketing with the Olympics in Sochi. What's it been like working with the Russians?
It's a challenge. And the reason for that is that you're talking about a community that has never seen foreigners. Everyone speaks Russian. No one has ever done a business transaction with anyone outside of Russia.
And you're dealing with Russians from Sochi, not Russians from Moscow who come to Sochi.
That's correct. Mm. You know, everything is being done in Sochi. During the Olympic Games, unfortunately, a lot of the administrative approvals came only from Moscow, which made things very challenging in Sochi. But the people in Sochi are, you know, they haven't experienced this kind of international thing. This is something that's really been dropped on them. I mean, it's a shell shock. It really is.
What's your best story of just how challenging things were for you in Sochi?
I would say it was the little things. It was the lack of credit card machines. It was the inability to make phone calls. It was the language issue was tremendous. I was very lucky because I'm Armenian, and a substantial majority of Sochi is Armenian. So I was able to get by with the language. But, you know, for foreigners, it'll be tough.
Paul Varadian, an Armenian-American businessman based here in Boston. We just heard that a lot of Sochi's residents speak Armenian, but it's a ways away from Armenia. Sounds like there's a good backstory there. So for today's The World That Was, we're going to look at the history of Sochi, and our resident walking encyclopedia, Chris Wolf, is here. So what are Armenians doing in Sochi, Chris?
Marco, it all goes back to the fact that Sochi is one of those unfortunate areas on the periphery of great empires, Roman, Persian, Byzantine, Turkish, and of course, Russian. And the area has changed hands a bunch of times, and along with that, the people have been pushed around as well. So most of the indigenous or Circassian people were Muslim people who fought the Russians for a long time in the 19th century. We're all pushed out from the 1860s or so, and all kinds of Christian immigrants were pulled in from all other parts of the Russian Empire, and so Armenians were part of that flow. And then, of course, there was another influx with the Armenian genocide by the Turks in the First World War.
And the Armenians stayed, or at least their language did, it sounds like.
Actually, the population that identifies as Armenian has been increasing slightly as the censuses go by, and most of them seem to be concentrated in the town of Adler.
Adler doesn't sound like a very Russian name, although maybe it's an Armenian name. I'm also hearing about another place called Krasnaya Polyana, where the outdoor events are taking place for the Olympics. What is the connection with Sochi?
Well, Sochi is a river, a district, and a city. The city is not really hosting any of the Olympic events. Most of the indoor events are in the town of Adler, which is what's called a micro-district of the Sochi region. And then the outdoor ones are up in about 30 miles away in the mountains at Krasnaya Polyana. So you could almost say there's not the Sochi Olympics at all. But Sochi is a kind of the bigger district, like the, almost like a county in kind of Western American kind of sense.
Hence the Sochi Olympics. So where does the name Sochi come from? What does it mean?
Well, it's an old Ubik word.
Ubik?
For Ubik, yes. Ubik is one of the languages of the Northwest Caucasian language group, which of course you're familiar with.
How could I forget?
And basically it's Circassian, people who nowadays have always identified themselves as Adige, but in history were Circassian. And they've been there for thousands of years, and the Ubiks was one of the languages. Soachi was the name of a tribe and river there, and they were the people who lived there predominantly before the Russians finally secured control of the region in as recently as 1864. You could almost say the Sochi region is kind of like Florida historically. It's a holiday destination built after a vicious kind of campaign of colonization and conquest. You know, in Florida it was the Seminoles, and in Caucasus it was the Muslim tribes that were displaced in about the same time frame, about 150 to 200 years ago.
Oh, interesting. That's actually a helpful metaphor. Now, you've been talking about kind of the Christian makeup and the Russians' desire to kind of fill this area with Christians. What is the connection then to any threat from Islamic militants to disrupt these games?
Well, the Russian campaign to clear the coast of all the Muslim peoples that they'd been fighting for a couple of generations in the 19th century was particularly brutal. Some people call it like the first modern ethnic cleansing. Cleansing was one of the words that the Russian officers used and wrote about in their desire to try and get rid of the people who had caused them so much trouble for so long. And you're talking about a really kind of tough mountaineer kind of group. Think Scottish Highlanders or, you know, parts of our own Appalachia, tight-knit clans of people who really don't like getting along with outsiders or being told what to do by outsiders. So the Russians basically were annoyed that foreign countries like Britain would sell them weapons along the coast. So they basically decided to get rid of everybody who lived along the coast. There were villages were burnt and they were shipped off to Turkey. In fact, they were distributed, the Circassian people, throughout the Ottoman Empire. And even now, if you travel through the Middle East, you can come across villages and towns that identify as Circassian, like there's one just outside of Jerusalem. The city of Amman, Jordan, was founded by these refugees in the 19th century.
And the memories of these people who were pushed out, these Muslims who were pushed out, a long kind of sense of history for them?
Exactly. In fact, the principal threat by the leader of the Islamic Emirate of the Caucasus, the Al-Qaeda link group that's threatened to disrupt the Olympics, Doku Umarov, specifically said, we cannot allow this prancing to take place on the bones of our ancestors. There are some pretty brutal reports I was reading from Russian officers complaining about the heaps of bodies that lined the coast or in the Sochi district during the ethnic cleansing. People just starved or frozen or died of diseases from being all herded together in insanitary conditions before deportation.
Another view of Sochi from the world's Chris Wolf with today's World That Was. Thank you very much, Chris.
You're welcome, Marco.
The movie The Monuments Men comes out today. It's about an American platoon in World War II trying to rescue artwork stolen by the Nazis. We've got a similar story. Poland's National Museum had a lot of art looted during the war, and just yesterday, one of the many missing paintings was finally returned, courtesy of the U.S. government.
On behalf of Homeland Security Investigations, it gives me great, great pleasure to be able to return to the people of Poland this valuable painting that was stolen more than 70 years ago. Stolen art, antiquities, and fraudulently acquired artifacts. These are the little-known casualties of war.
Ewa Juntuk-Giomecka is Poland's consul general in New York. Madam Consul, what went through your head when you were handed back this painting yesterday?
We are very happy, thanks to the cooperation with Special Agent in Charge James Hayes. We have celebrated such a returning of Polish art. It was a very moving event. Poland suffered greatly during the Second World War. Of course, the people are the most important. We lost 6 million Polish citizens, among them 3 million of Polish Jews, and many beautiful art objects. At the moment, on the list of still stolen objects that we are looking for, they are at about 70,000. Art objects.
70,000 still out there.
Yes, 70,000. That's a lot. But I'm very grateful to our partner on the American side. And yesterday, one of the significant art went with the minister back to Poland, to the place where it belongs, to the National Museum in Warsaw, where the art was stolen during the Second World War, probably in 1944 by Nazi Germans.
So tell us about this painting. I know it's from the 18th century. What do we see in it?
Yes. Well, it's a very well-known artist, a German artist. This is the Baptize by Saint Philip of a servant of Queen Kanaki Queen. And it's not a big piece of art, but it's beautiful with in such a brown colors, like beautiful Indian fall. That's the colors that appears on the painting. And we believe that it was during the war either destroyed. For years, we believe that it was lost forever. And the author of this painting is Jonathan Conrad Sikets, born in 79 and dying in 1768.
I understand that Poland has asked Russia to return several paintings seized by the Soviet Red Army at the end of World War II, including one by Bruegel. Any movement on that request?
Oh, well, we are trying to. I must say that it is much easier to work with the American side than with other partners. American side is helpful and very energetic. I can say that about other partners of ours.
Now, I don't know how much influence a Hollywood film studio has on the Department of Homeland Security, but was this partly timed to coincide with the release of this movie, The Monuments Men?
I must tell you, we were so surprised. Before the ceremony, all our guests on the American side and the Polish side, I invited them to my office. And so we talk about it. And suddenly someone said that, do you know that this movie is going to be tomorrow at the New York movie theaters? We didn't know nothing about it. Everyone was surprised except one person. So that was absolutely coincident. And I am happy about it because this way we have a very good gathering of press.
Yeah. Was that one person a woman by any chance, hoping that George Clooney would give the painting over?
Yes, yes. Well, you know, such a coincidence are very happy for us because otherwise it's not easy to have a very busy media to come to the Polish consulate in New York in Midtown Manhattan.
So you said the painting's already flown back to Warsaw. When will it be hanging in Poland's National Art Museum again?
We are trying to make a celebration of it because, after all, those pieces, they are like puzzles that they put together. This is the national heritage. So the Minister of Culture will organize a special ceremony to give this painting back to the National Museum in Warsaw. I think it will happen very soon.
Ewa Juntuk-Giomecka, Poland's Consul General in New York. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
It's been missing for 7 decades. Now see what it looks like. We've posted a picture of the recovered painting at PRI.org. Just before the break, let's step back even a little bit further in history. Okay, a lot further back. Scientists in Britain believe they've made a pretty astonishing find, the oldest set of human footprints outside of Africa. The prints were discovered last year on a beach in eastern England, frozen in time in layers of silt and sand. The prints were exposed by rough seas last year. Researchers photographed and made 3D scans of the footprints before they were washed away. The evidence was sent to, among others, Dr. Nick Ashton at the British Museum. He admits he was skeptical at first.
It was only when this overhead view was emailed through to me back in my office, I suddenly looked at it and opened up the file. I thought, that's absolutely amazing. You know, there is no doubt this really is human footprints.
After some careful study, Ashton and some other scientists estimate that the prints are, wait for it, between 800,000 and 1 million years old. Scientists hadn't believed there were even humans in Britain at that time. And that got Chris Stranger of London's Natural History Museum rethinking things.
This suggests that these people indeed had greater capabilities than we thought to expand really to the edge of the inhabited world at that time, and even surviving conditions that were actually slightly colder than the present day.
By the way, scientists say the placement of the prints seemed to indicate they were made by five different people, one adult and possibly up to four children. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. With the global spotlight on the Sochi Olympics, seems everyone's got a Russia story to tell. Even the British medical journal, The Lancet. It's just published a study finding that Russian adults have extraordinarily high rates of premature deaths. And according to the study, one of the causes is too much vodka. Crude stereotypes aside, let's hear from someone who's really familiar with Russians and vodka. Lawrence Sherrad is the author of a new book called Vodka Politics.
I still remember my first experience, essentially right as I got off the plane. I spent some time at Moscow State University in the 1990s, just coming out of the metro station, my first impression of Russia was this guy who was walking past the metro with this massive gushing head wound and blood dripping all over. And he seemed to be in a daze, and he was dashing his hand with vodka and then splashing the vodka onto his open wound. And that was shocking to me, first, you know, coming straight off the plane. But also, even more shocking was that it didn't seem to faze anyone else. This was a large marketplace, and
wow.
Everybody seemed to think that this was just, you know, part of everyday life, I suppose.
Right.
So that was, to me, was kind of shocking.
So it's everywhere and apparently also has medical properties. Politically, what does a glass or two or three of vodka mean?
There's been a long history of vodka diplomacy, if you will, in terms of these large banquets that Russians would throw anytime there's a big political event, and it had round after round of toasts, and you know, in some cases 20, 30 rounds of toasts even before the meal begins, and that oftentimes is enough to get to even the most alcohol tolerant person a little bit tipsy and in their cups, I suppose. You know, Churchill ran into this when he went to visit Stalin in the 1940s. You know, it happens again in the 1990s when you have foreign dignitaries visiting Boris Yeltsin's Russia. It can be sort of an instrumental thing to keep people off balance and, you know, maybe belie some secrets that they might otherwise be harboring.
How and why did vodka become such a big part of Russian life?
If you go back hundreds of years, it wasn't as though Russians were always drinking vodka. You know, just like most of Europe, there was a deep tradition of brewing, you know, meads and kvass and beers, ales and porters. And that was essentially the drink of Russia. Well, then you have the introduction of distilling technologies by about the 1500s, 1600s. And gradually it starts to take hold. And part of the reason is that there was at that point a monopoly by the government on essentially on the tavern trade. And so if all the revenue from the sale of alcohol went to the state. What you tended to find in sort of these early Russian taverns was an entire array of alcoholic drinks. So you had your beers and your wines and your meads, and you had some distilled vodkas. But the thing was is that you got a lot more bang for your buck, not only as a customer, but also as the state, in terms of, you know, the price that you can get out of vodka. And slowly over time, you know, it sort of muscled out its competition, that they didn't want to provide beers in these taverns anymore, and they didn't want to provide wine because it wasn't profitable, and that left people with the only option, which was vodka. And so that's kind of how it gets entrenched early on, and that's, I think, where a lot of this comes from, is not so much, you know, alcohol and an appreciation for vodka being hardwired into Russian DNA, but as the result of these political and economic decisions that have really deep historical roots.
All in moderation. Mark Lawrence Sherrad, he's the author of Vodka Politics, Alcohol Autocracy, and the Secret History of the Russian State. The book came out this week. Thank you very much, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be hearing a lot from Russia over the next 2 weeks with the Winter Olympics in Sochi. We'll also be hearing a lot of Russian words and names. And I'll tell you, they're not always pronounced the way you and I might think. That includes the name of the Olympic host city itself. When I hear Russian speakers say Sochi, I'm hearing it pronounced in a way I've never heard. So I asked Martha Figueroa Clark for some help. She thinks about this stuff all the time as part of the BBC pronunciation unit.
The anglicized pronunciation is Sochi.
Sochi.
Yes.
So how do the Russians say it?
Yeah, Sochi.
Sochi.
Sochi. Mm. The vowel is somewhere in between the British English O and O, so that's why it tends to be anglicized as Sochi.
You've also provided pronunciation advice for many of the venues where the competition is going to happen. One of the skiing venues is called, and I'm not going to overstudy it, Krasnaya Polyana.
Okay, it's Krasnaya Polyana in Russian. So we anglicize it as Krasnaya Polyana. So the stress in the first word is actually on the first syllable, but people often see Russian words that end with A-Y-A and assume that the stress is on the penultimate syllable, but it's not always the case.
Krasnaya Polyana.
Polyana. In the past, the word Krasnaya actually meant beautiful, whereas nowadays it has the meaning red.
Well, then there's the Bolshoi Ice Dome, where the skating's going to happen. Now, most people, like myself, say Bolshoi, wrong?
In Russian, it's stressed on the last syllable, so it's Bolshoi. In that sense, you would anglicize it as Bolshoi.
Then there's the Shaiba Arena, that's the ice hockey venue. I'm sure I got that wrong.
It's actually pronounced Shaiba, so anglicized Shaiba.
Who's the Russian athlete that's really going to make all the broadcasters stumble?
I think probably one that's deceptively simple-looking when you see it written down, but it's Nikita Kryukov, because you don't get that ryu sound in English, obviously, because we don't roll the R, so it ends up having to be an extra syllable, Kryukov.
Now, apparently Nikita is a cross-country skier. I'm not sure how many Americans will be actually watching that, and will mispronounce
right,
it anyway.
Okay. But Tatiana Velasajar.
I'm hearing a lot of sounds that I don't think I could repeat.
Velasajar, we would anglicize that.
Velasajar.
Yeah, that was quite nice.
You know, I have to start acting Russian to get these right.
Yeah, that was a nice Russian velarized L there, Velasajar.
So are there any venues where if you get the pronunciation wrong, you'll end up by saying something dirty in Russian?
Of the ones that I've researched, I don't think there are any dangers there. you never know. Sometimes you can be surprised by the way that people can mispronounce things.
Martha Figueroa Clark of the BBC's Pronunciation Unit, thanks for being on hand for us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Russia's national anthem there, the metal version that is by the band Lube. They're from a Moscow suburb called Lubertsy. They're not demonized in Russia the way Hendrix was by some here when he deconstructed the Star Spangled Banner. No, Lube were on the playlist for today's opening ceremonies in Sochi. Lube is Russian President Vladimir Putin's favorite band. The band members have a habit of wearing old-style military garb, and maybe Putin likes more than just their music. Can't argue with taste. The world's anthem was composed by Eric Goldberg. I'm Marco Werman in the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. See you back here on Monday.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Annenberg Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, GatesFoundation.org, the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security at Carnegie.org. The Henry Luce Foundation for Increased Understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, Linda Larson and Jerry Johnson, the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Noor Hall.
PRI, Public Radio International.